88.1 KFCF Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. Up now, Women's Magazine.
Feminist women.
Mulheres feministas.
Zanone feminist.
Banyu Vachikonzero Chevakadze.
Nessa.
Mujeres feministas.
Young femini. Femme activist.
Nari Mukti.
Matatan na babae.
Kechimai. Ka ishk.
This week on Women's Magazine.
There's a high percentage, more than a quarter of these people die after usually a woman calls 911 for help with an emotionally disturbed child or because of domestic abuse. As mothers and people trying to deal with violence in our households, we are on our own pretty much.
We'll talk with Arlene Eisen about a new report on the killing of 313 black people by police or security guards in 2012. And we'll deconstruct the war on obesity with authors and activists Jen Larson and Virgie Tovar.
I live a fabulous life, and I know that that's something I've been told that I'm not allowed to have because I'm a 250-pound woman, and yet, you know, here I am doing it. And because I study gender and sexuality, I know a lot about myths that parade around as truth.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Women's Magazine. I'm Kate Raphael. I hope you've gotten your taxes in, which I haven't. Coming up in the second half of our show today, I'll talk with two tremendously smart, honest, and funny women about the war on obesity and what it has to do with the war on women. Jen Larson and Virgie Tovar will join me. But first, Operation Ghetto Storm. At least 313 black people were killed by police, security guards, or vigilantes in 2012. That's one every 28 hours. I'll be back with that story in just a minute.
You believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. You believe in freedom, cannot rest. Hear me talking to you. We believe in freedom.
We believe
and
in
freedom.
Nearly every day in this country, at least every 28 hours, a black person is killed by police, security guards, or vigilante claiming state-sanctioned authority. The vast majority of these extrajudicial killings, 93%, are men. The Malcolm X grassroots movement has documented 313 such killings in 2012 in a new report entitled Operation Ghetto Storm. Arlene Eisen is the principal author of that report. She joins me now in studio. Arlene is a freelance journalist, longtime anti-racist and anti-imperialist activist, and the author of the book Women of Vietnam. She's a member of the Malcolm X Solidarity Committee and the mother of two young black men. We were also hoping to be joined by Rosa Clemente, a member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, hip-hop artist and journalist, and a contributor to this report as well, but unfortunately she was not available at the last minute. Arlene, talk about how you compiled this report.
Well, it's basically the product of about a year's research. Trayvon Martin was murdered the end of February last year, and I was in a conversation with a comrade at Malcolm X, grassroots movement, Kali Yakuno, talking about the problem of people seeing Trayvon's murder as an isolated case. And we were talking about how there was a lack of data on other cases, similar cases, and how they showed that this sort of extrajudicial killing was systematic. And so that began the research. Actually, I did a very, very quick 3 days of very intensive research and put out a report, the first quarterly report. And then in July, we put out a six-month report, which showed that there had been 120 cases. And I was convinced, based on that research, that there were way more cases out there, but there is no national database. The feds do not require police departments to report these killings. So basically, it's a very painstaking kind of click and click and click kind of internet research. And at this point, I've verified 313 cases. I think there are probably at least 80 or 90 more out there that I couldn't track down whether what their race was or whether they actually died or what their name was. There'd be a brief note in a newspaper saying the police killed a man on such and such an avenue in such a city. Philadelphia, Chicago are notoriously bad on reporting these cases, I think deliberately so.
So how did you find all these newspapers? Did you go to the library and look through microfilm, or were you looking all online? Or
pretty much online. If you Google officer involved shooting in such and such a city, you'll get a bunch of cases, and they'll lead it to more cases and more cases. Wikipedia has a list, which is very, very incomplete, that doesn't provide the race at all and generally only gives the initial press release that the police put out.
Well, you know, we're not supposed to talk about race. We're post-racial, right?
Yeah, right. But our point is that the number of black people killed is way, way out of proportion to their percentage in the population, and that's not an accident, that it's quite systematic and that these killings are part of a war that's been waged on black people forever, but in modern times, at least since the 1960s, to suppress the urban uprisings in Watts and Harlem and Chicago and Detroit and so on.
And that leads to the title of the report, Operation Ghetto Storm. What does that mean? How did you choose that title?
I first read it in a report that this guy named Balco did called Overkill, which is a libertarian view of the militarization of police. And he found it on a T-shirt in a police training camp where the police were being trained in military tactics. And one of the trainers had it on his T-shirt, Operation Ghetto Storm, with a picture of a cityscape in flames. And it basically is a takeoff on Operation Desert Storm, which was the code name for the first invasion and occupation of Iraq. The reason why we thought it was appropriate as a title for this report was because it really is a war. I mean, police are no longer, if they ever were, in black communities to protect and serve or even to enforce laws. They're there on a war footing. There is this us and them mentality, kill or be killed. And they're there to control and suppress the population. And even if you look at the most recent revelations that came out in the stop and frisk trial in New York City, I don't know if your listeners have followed that, but the Center for Constitutional Rights has brought this suit against the city of New York and the police department. And they have played tapes showing that the police consciously say, the purpose of stop and frisk is to make sure every black person understands that the police own the streets, that they don't own the streets.
And you also talked with some of the families of people who had been killed, right?
But that isn't really the basis of the research. I mean, with 313 cases, most of the information that I have about families comes from the news stories. And also, since the corporate media mainly relies on police press releases. What I had to do is once I got a name and a date for somebody who was killed, you know, I kind of scoured the web looking for Facebook entries, looking for comments, community newspapers, leaflets, whatever I could find that gave the family and the community point of view. And invariably, what the families say is, why?
Well, what about why? I mean, if you read the police accounts, in almost every case, the person was either waving a weapon or in the process of committing a felony. And if you read the family's accounts and the accounts of friends and people who witnessed the event, it seems like inevitably or in almost every situation, the person was doing nothing threatening and had never been involved in any illegal activity. I mean, how many of the cases that you documented involved people who were unarmed? Let's start with that. Or what proportion about?
Well, it's not such a simple answer, because what happens is, for example, like in the case that happened here in Vallejo last spring, a man whose last name was Barrett, who supposedly had a gun and actually had a metallic object that held his business cards. And lots of times the police claim there's a gun when there isn't, or they, to give them the benefit of the doubt, a mistake of cell phone or a cigarette case or something of that sort for a gun. And you have to also remember that in many of the states, in most of the states where these killings happen, possession of a gun is not illegal. And in many of these states, you don't even have to register a gun. You can conceal a weapon. I mean, it's not illegal. And In the corporate press, generally, possession of a weapon on the part of someone who's already died, particularly if they're black, is justification enough for killing them. Whereas in these very same jurisdictions, you have all this brouhaha about the right to bear arms. So there's an interesting contradiction there.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So of the 113, 136, or 44%, had absolutely no weapon at all at the time they were executed. Then another 83, or 27%, allegedly possessed a gun. But like I said, it's been demonstrated over and over that the police lie about gun possession. By the way, this is not in the report, but I just read on Huffington Post the other day, again from Balco, who's a great source of information about the police. He interviewed a police expert whose job it was to train police on policies about when deadly force was appropriate. And he said, even though he's been studying this stuff for 10 years, he was shocked by the guy's response. He says, we don't talk about that. The only thing we talk about is how to justify it to the press after they've killed somebody. What initially triggered these deadly encounters? How did they start? 43% began with some sort of racial profiling. And this is where the issue of comparing it with white shooting is just impossible. That 43% of these deadly encounters began because the so-called suspect appeared, behaved, or drove suspiciously. 19% of these encounters began with calls to 911 for help with emotionally disturbed household members, usually children, sometimes parents, sometimes spouses, but people with diagnosed mental health issues, 19%.
Well, that leads me to a question that I wanted to ask, which has to do with the role of black women in these situations, or the situation that black women are put in many cases. Because in many situations, I think the people that are calling the police in those situations are women, are mothers or lovers, you know, who are afraid for their lives a lot of times.
Right.
So your report has a brief section on how black women are affected. I mean, as I said, 93% of the people who the killings that you documented were of men. Some of the women were killed actually in car chases, I think, and some of them were accidental victims or, unintended victims. But the report does talk some about the broader context in which women are involved in these killings. Can you talk about that a little?
I'm sorry Rosa isn't here, because when we were first talking about doing this report, it was Rosa who said to me, you have to show how this stuff affects women. Our society, particularly since 9/11, has been totally militarized, not just because of the foreign wars, but because of the militarization of the police at home. And this involves several million people under arms. And there's an enormous effect of this militarization on the culture itself, so that in terms of breeding a kind of macho, violent, predatory culture that I think has an enormous effect on encouraging rape and all kinds of other gender-based violence. The places where you really see a systematic, the institutionalization of patriarchy play out in these killings is that there's a high percentage, more than a quarter of these 313 people die after usually a woman calls 911 for help with an emotionally disturbed child or because of domestic abuse. When I saw that data, what came to mind was how we are pretty, as mothers and people trying to deal with violence in our households, we are on our own pretty much. What has happened in this country is that whatever support used to exist, for example, in Oakland, they used to be called something called the Black Women's Anti-Violence Project in the 1980s, that had a hotline and people could call them for intervention with abusive partners or abusive men, period, for counseling, for resources, for intervention. And there are still some a smattering of projects like that around the country. But more often than not, the anti-domestic violence movement has been totally absorbed as pretty much an arm of the state. They're kind of intermediaries and between the women who are targets of the abuse and the police. And that pretty much just contributes to the problem, not just because the police end up killing the men involved without trial, etc., but also it further disempowers women. And ditto for support with emotionally disturbed family members. So more often than not, a mother will call 911, not even for the police, because remember, when you call 911, you call the same number for the police and the ambulance. And she'll say, I need help getting my child, and not always a male child. Sharmell Edwards, for example, this woman with a diagnosed mental illness, was smothered to death by police after her grandmother, actually, I believe, called for an ambulance. The police came, they couldn't control her, and they ended up smothering her. And that issue of control is really the key issue of why people get killed.
Because you could say, well, if a woman calls the police, she might live to regret it, but if she doesn't, she might not live at all. And the report asserts that there should be grassroots community-based alternatives for people facing dangerous situations. But as you've said, these alternatives in most places that people would find themselves don't exist. And I know that even here, even though there are two groups that I want to mention in the Bay Area that definitely have an anti-retributive justice approach to violence against women, and that's San Francisco Women Against Rape and Mujeres Unidas, both have projects that are about trying to find non-state alternatives for women in violent situations, but still it's about looking for those alternatives and not really like those alternatives exist. So if a woman is in a situation where she feels like her life is in danger or might be in danger, either from an intimate partner or a child or a neighbor, you know, what would you advocate that she do in that very situation?
I personally don't feel like I have the right to tell a woman what she should do in any given situation. I mean, if she were my friend and I had a chance to talk to her and hear all the details and brainstorm with her about alternatives and so on, maybe I would give her some advice. But in the abstract, I think it's an impossible question. And all I can say is that to encourage a kind of model like this, there's an organization called Philly Stands Up. There's another one in Seattle called Community Against Rape and Abuse, abbreviated CARA. The Audre Lorde Project called Safe Outside the System, which is particularly for LGBT people. And also there's something called the Gulabi Gang. I don't know if people have seen images of these women. They wear pink saris in northern India, and they carry these long bamboo poles. Very often their presence outside a house where a woman is screaming or a hut where women are screaming is enough to cool the man down.
Periodically, when somebody's killed, like Oscar Grant or Alan Bluford here in Oakland or Kimani Gray recently in New York or Trayvon Martin, especially when it's a young unarmed teen, there's a brief explosion of protest, which will lead to a small amount of press attention to the issue. But then it dies down and it doesn't seem to lead to any systemic change or build a broader social movement. Which I think is different than in the 60s and 70s, often riots that began, that were triggered by one of these police killings, ended up, you know, resulting in anti-poverty programs and money being allocated actually for institutions that might result in more community empowerment or more community control of the police. Do you think it's possible at this point to move beyond these kind of short-lived, essentially symbolic conflagrations to something with broader significance for social change?
We're in very different historic times than the 60s. And unfortunately, I think the state learned the lessons of the 60s better than we did in a way. And I think the Obama presidency has done a lot to misdirect political energy towards looking to the government for solutions and for defining the issues in ways that are not helpful for solving them. For example, you know, the whole myth of the post-racial society makes it very difficult to see the problem of the systematic killing, and not just killing, the mass incarceration, the total surveillance. At the same time, and I can't really speak for MSGM, but they have put out a handbook of self-defense organizing called Let Our Motto Be Resistance, and it's available on their website, as is this report, MSGM.org.
MXGM.org.
Yes, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. Basically, I think one of the main points in that handbook is to spread the word, because there has been so much of a cloud, so much confusion, so much reliance on the Democratic Party to solve problems faced by the black community, that's really the first step, is a kind of mass education campaign.
Operation Ghetto Storm is a new report issued by the Malcolm X grassroots movement documenting 313 extrajudicial killings of black people by police, security guards, or vigilantes in 2012. And we will, of course, link that report to our website, which is kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. Arlene Eisen is the principal author of that report. Arlene, thanks so much for your time.
Hear me talking to you. We will believe in freedom.
We will believe
and not
in
rest until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons is as important as the killing of white men. White mothers, sons, do you believe in
with me if you like it?
We who believe in freedom
and not freedom telling our
man. The older I get, the better I know that the secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. Cause to me, young people come first.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael. Coming up, we look at another form of discrimination that can at times be equally dangerous. How is the war on obesity really a war on women's bodies? I'll speak with Virgie Tovar and Jen Larson when we come back.
Joy, you have such a pretty face. If you just lost 30 pounds, you'd be gorgeous.
I'm already gorgeous.
You've got such a pretty face.
It's a shame about your weight.
You know, you've got such great style. It's a shame about your personality.
You don't turn on the radio.